Hello, this is Zsófilter, the feminist podcast of Partizan, an independent media channel in Hungary. My name is Zsófi Balog, and my guest today is Dr. Christian Fiala, MD, PhD, and specialist in obstetrics and gynecology. He's the medical director of Gynmed Clinic in Vienna and Salzburg, Austria, that specializes in treatment and prevention in taking care of women with unwanted pregnancies. He is the representative and former president of the International Federation of Professional Abortion and Contraception Associates and member of several other associations in the field. He also founded the Museum on Contraception and Abortion located in Vienna, which shows how humanity gained control over fertility in a long and desperate struggle. Our international listeners, welcome to Partizan's podcast channel. You can find out more about us on our YouTube and social media platforms. And if you can, please support our work through the links in the show notes. Dr. Fiala, thank you for talking to me today.
My pleasure.
And thank you for having me in your clinic in Vienna. I've read a lot about your work and what is really, I think, interesting and, of course, very great to have, thinking about it as a feminist, is that it's very woman-centered. And I think a lot of feminist issues or women's issues that we cover or I cover in my podcast, I find that a lot of times the root of an issue is that women are not taken seriously as, you know, sovereign humans and to make decisions in their own life. And I think abortion care and unwanted pregnancies is a topic where it's really apparent. I know that you worked in countries before that where abortion was illegal. And I wonder, what could you tell us if societies decide that they restrict abortion care or prohibit it? What happens to women?
Well, first, thank you for the invitation. And I fully agree with everything you said. Abortion actually is a very important topic. And I think that is the reason why all societies, all governments try to control it. If it would be an unimportant topic, no one would care about it. But all religions and all those in power, they try to interfere. And strangely enough, they all try to do the same, whether it is Muslim or Christian religion, whether it's communist or Western countries. No, sorry, the communists were an exception, but all other countries, all other governments, whether in the North or South, whether it is Hungary or United States, they all do the same, interestingly. They try to impose their will on women or on couples and try to force couples to have as many children as possible. And that's a very strange observation, actually, if you think about it, because first you would think, well, If you would be in the government, that your first priority would be to enable people to live a life as they imagine, and that would benefit not only the individual, but also the family and the society as a whole. If you have a population which is happy and self-determined and can live a peaceful life, then a society as a whole would blossom and develop, and you would liberate incredible powers, incredible sources and energy. And you would think, well, that should be the primary goal. And the limitation of natural fertility is actually one of the most important aspects in life on this earth. Women are fertile. Women can get pregnant for 35 years, from 15 to 50, roughly. And if we have sex in a male ejaculation, there are 100 million sperms. Each ejaculation is 100 million sperms. So if you take that together, that's an abundance of fertility, which is really breathtaking. And the result is that women have 12 to 15 pregnancies in their lifetime on average. And of course, that's not only far too much for every woman, but it is far too much to take care of every child in a responsible way. It's impossible, 12 to 15 children. So when you look back in history, and this is true over all societies, virtually all individuals, women mainly, but of course all their partners, had one primary objective in their life. And that was to limit the natural fertility, this abundance of natural fertility, to limit that to the individually desired number of children. And throughout human history, that struggle was lost simply because there was no effective means of contraception, no effective means to limit natural fertility. And so mainly women, but of course also their partners, were exposed to this abundance of children, and they suffered incredibly, and many women died. And they tried human history. Humans tried everything possible. And that really means what the words are saying. Everything that is possible to limit this natural fertility, because they were so desperate. If every intercourse you have or every second intercourse you have leads to a child, you get desperate very fast. But this struggle for fertility control was unsuccessful until 1930, when Knaus and Ogino, the Austrian and Japanese gynecologists, they discovered for the first time in human history, they discovered that there was an ovulation and when it was. That gave a little bit understanding, but still little means to limit the natural fertility. But then based on their findings in 1960, the contraceptive pill was developed, mainly by two American researchers in the final stages. But also, what is interesting, Gedeon Richter, this world-renowned pharmaceutical company from Hungary, also developed contraceptive pill very early onwards. So just showing that this strife, this struggle for fertility control, was really a worldwide struggle through all political systems. But only in 1960, with the marketing of the contraceptive pill, for the first time in human history, women had the means to limit the natural fertility according to their individually desired number of children. And that is really, if you think about it, that's quite impressive. So all these thousands of years, humans had no way to limit their natural fertility. In 1960, suddenly, for the first time, women could say, no, I want less children. I want that at a specific time with a specific partner. I mean, if you think what is a revolution, then certainly this fulfills all criteria of a revolution. And it turned life on this planet upside down. And it enabled this limitation of natural fertility, enabled a development which we have seen since 1960, which has been unimaginable before. Because it freed women and their partners suddenly to do a lot of things and still have the number of children they wanted to guide in life. So that was a true revolution. And again, you would think, oh, if you would be the government or a responsible, political responsible person, you would make it a world a day of be happy that this is, and you would do everything to allow access to this contraceptive pill for everyone, free of charge, of course, because you really want to support the individual people to have only these, the number of children they can. And on the other hand, to contribute to society. And if you look at the reaction of societies throughout the world, actually, it was very restrictive. They locked the pill up. They locked it especially up in the first years. They prevented it to be given to women who needed it most, mainly women who had not been married. So in the first years, it was only given to married women. Okay, they also need it. But if they had one child or one more child or two more children, they probably could have managed. But those women who were unmarried, who had no partner to support them, they were really in dire straits of this contraceptive pill, and they were not prevented from... You know, and even until our days, until now, 2025, the pill is not freely accessible. Every woman still needs a prescription in virtually all countries, at least in countries in Europe and North America, Australia, New Zealand. There is this prescription. So a woman needs to go to a doctor. The doctor needs to sign us a paper. And only with this authorization, a woman can get the pill in the pharmacy. Even if a woman takes the pill for 10 years and she knows very well what she needs, she still needs to go to a doctor on a regular basis, pay this doctor for this signature, and go to a pharmacy. So it is very obvious, first, that women are not equal, that they are patronized by our societies. And I say that as a man, specifically, And I say it, I'm not happy with it, because men and women, we make love together. So we should underline this word together. We are not fighting each other in making love. We do that together. And it is also in our interests as men that women are treated equally and that they can develop. That is our also in our has advantages for us, of course. So I think it is a very stupid decision of almost all societies still to restrict the contraceptive pill and prevent proper use, because actually the state is not in a position to decide the timing or the number of children the people have. And the state is not very helpful either once there are children, and it's not very helpful in raising children. So it is left to the parents, the women firsthand, but then also the parents. And so I think they should decide. So it is long overdue that we make the contraceptive pill without prescription, over the counter, OTC, as it is called. That is overdue. If that would be done, if the pill would be given without a, women could buy it without a prescription, that would be a recognition, actually a very important symbol also, that a government or state or society would recognize the interests of women and recognize them as really equal and free, especially in a democratic society. Because if you think about what is the definition of a democratic society, is that we as people, we elect our representatives, we pay them with our taxes to act, well, in our interest. In contrast to monarchies or dictatorships, they act in their interest. Okay, you could say a monarch doesn't have the moral obligation to make a pill prescription free, but a democratic government, which is elected by us, has no moral right to patronize the people who have elected them. So you see, there is also on a moral, ethical level, there's a fundamental contradiction and a very sad, very strong and sad sign that women are not equal. Yes. And they have limited rights. They are second-class citizens. And for all those who say, who argue that the contraceptive pill can have many side effects and is dangerous, I would encourage them to go to a hardware store and look at all the instruments that are sold there free of charge, all kinds of saws and potentially very dangerous instruments. And if you go on a weekend to a hospital, to a traumatology unit, you see how many accidents happen with these instruments, because they are potentially very dangerous, mainly used by men. But I've never seen a call in a hardware store to limit the sales of these instruments to prescription or psychological test or training or whatever, which I think should be done, because there are very good arguments that a lot of these instruments, you should only be used if you have been educated and trained to prevent accidents. But so obviously society thinks, well, if it is a man, then it's his own fault and his own decision. He's old enough to decide whether or not he can go for a training if he wants. And if he doesn't want, it's his own business. Which I think it has some strength, that argument. But if we apply that to men, I think we should also apply it to women.
And of course, men's sexual behavior is not patronized ever in the way that women's are. Like in Hungary, I think we are so very used to now being patronized over the years by the government that we don't even really notice it anymore, or we're just so used to not think about our issues as really separate, important issues to fight for. And I think abortion care is one of the things that we got kind of, I want to say, almost comfortable, because even though we have a very right-wing conservative government that patronizes us, the question of abortion, apart from this bill that they introduced a couple of years ago about the so-called heartbeat bill, apart from that, to be honest, abortion hasn't been, put on the list of things that the government targets and talks about. And I think it's because everybody, I think, or most of the people agree that it should be accessible. But at the same time, I'm kind of also worried, because we haven't had education and ongoing information exchange about why abortion care or contraceptive care is necessary, why women should be treated as people who can make decisions and not be patronized. And so I wonder what would happen if this topic would be put on the table again. And I don't know if we have enough push or strength behind a movement, or even if we have a movement at all, apart from some women's rights organizations who sometimes campaign to really protect this right, and even, of course, liberate it even more and make the restrictions go away with legislation. Of course, we look to Austria as an example where contraceptive and abortion care is available freely, or a lot more freely, of course, than in Hungary. But I know that in the past it wasn't the case. And of course, the tables have turned, because it used to be the case that Austrian women went to Hungary when it was more free there. And now it's the opposite. And you in your clinic see a lot of Hungarian, also other women from other countries. Can you talk about that a little bit and how the attitude is here? Because, of course, we look at Austria from Hungary, that it's a very free country with a lot of liberties that we don't have over there. But at the same time, I'm sure it's not as a simple picture. And I'm sure that here also there are struggles that maybe a healthcare provider has to face.
Actually, women are patronized when it comes to pregnancies in every country, to my knowledge. I'm not aware of a single country in the world where women are really free to decide and where their decision is accepted without putting a question mark on it when it comes to pregnancies. And that's very sad. Austria, it's true, Austria, women have more autonomy. I don't think it's right to say we are more liberal, because it's not about liberal. It's about recognizing the needs and the personal decisions of women. Women have more freedom to decide on their sexuality, on the most intimate aspect of life, their sexuality and fertility, in Austria than compared to Hungary. But at the same time, the restrictions you have in Hungary are very equal also in Germany. And it is very interesting that many people point with a finger to Hungary and they forget about Germany. And in Austria, women have to pay the contraception and the abortion themselves out of their own pocket. And if they are lucky and they have a partner who understands, he will participate. But basically, it's a woman who has to pay. And we are the only country in Western Europe where women have to pay contraception and abortion out of their own pocket. In all other Western European countries, at least abortion is paid by Social Security, or as of course. So if you look at it in European comparison, it's very interesting, because there are huge differences from one country to the other. The current situation is a result of a compromise of a historical development. If you had someone in the past in your country who fought very strongly for freedom of individuals, then you had a very liberal law. If you didn't have someone, or you, on the contrary, you had someone, just take Poland as an example, where they had this Polish Pope, Wojtyla. In 1903, he went to the Polish parliament and he said, I helped you to overcome the dictatorship of communism, you owe me a favor. And then they decided to make abortion illegal again, although it had been very legal under communist rules. So it's always a political compromise, the current situation. And unfortunately, in Hungary, the political compromise is also very restrictive, which doesn't help. And it's very cynical, because if you compare the birth rate of different countries in Europe, the countries with the highest birth rate are France and Sweden. These are the countries who give women the most freedom, also in abortion, not only, but also in abortion care. So a liberal abortion law does not lead to many abortions. It leads to women being able to terminate unwanted pregnancies. But what is also the case, at the same time in France and Sweden, they encourage and support couples with wanted pregnancies. And maybe that is the biggest problem in the public debate, that there is a huge misunderstanding and no one really recognizes this huge fundamental difference between a wanted pregnancy and an unwanted pregnancy. For in the public debate, it's just a pregnancy, and then either the woman continues or doesn't continue. But there's a fundamental difference, because most people, not all, but most people want children, but they want them with a specific partner at a specific time, and they want children at a time when they are able to guide a child into life in a responsible way. So it's a very thoughtful process. And then they decide and they look around and they look around which support, to which extent they get support from society. Like kindergarten is a good example. And in Austria, the kindergarten opening hours are very limited. So if you have a child, you need to discuss with, and you have a job, you need to adapt with your working hours as a parent. You have to adapt to the opening hours of a kindergarten. And of course, that is not encouraging people. If you look at, again, at Sweden and France, of course, the opening hours of the kindergartens, they are adapted to the working hours of the parents because they are service institution and they need to do the service. If they open late and the parents have to start working before, then it is not possible. And that will discourage couples to have children or have more children. And that is just one of the many examples. So these restrictions in unwanted pregnancies don't lead to a higher birth rate for a very simple reason. And most governments, like the government in Hungary, but also other governments, also Merkel and other governments, also in Austria currently, they don't understand this fundamental difference between unwanted and wanted children. And they don't understand that what a society needs to do is to encourage people, women and couples, in their desire to have wanted children. At the same time, they need to help women and couples to prevent unwanted pregnancies, even having unrestricted access to abortion to terminate an unwanted pregnancy, because there's one simple reason why women want an abortion or need an abortion. It's because they don't see themselves able to have another child and guide another child into life in a responsible way. If you are not in a position to have another child, you are not in a position. It is simply not possible. So it is really stupid. One of the most stupid things a society or government can do is to force women to continue an unwanted pregnancy. And to force a woman to continue an unwanted pregnancy because a woman want an abortion because they say we are not able to guide another child into life. So we need to terminate the pregnancy before there's a child. If the government prevents then an abortion, it is just aggravating a problem. It's not helping this. And then the child is there. And your neighbor country, Romania, had this social experiment, if you can call it, with Ceausescu, this former dictator. He really made abortion not only illegal, but he imposed very strict controls. And he physically forced women to continue unwanted pregnancies to term. And then he said he built these houses for the children. He said, yeah, well, no problem. You can give me the children. We take care of them. But this is absurd, as a state is never able to replace the work of parents. And then you had these terrible problems with these children gangs and this terrible situation in these children's houses in Romania, which were all the result of this very rigid illegal abortion law. So in essence, there is no alternative, no sensible alternative to give the individual women as men a free decision and also enable them to put their decision into practice over the number of children they want to have and the timing, meaning women and men should have free access, unrestricted access to contraception and abortion services. At the same time, the government should encourage people in their desire to have wanted children.
And I think, yeah, we really arrived to the heart of the issue. And I think this is what you're talking about now. This is what's really missing from the arguments and from the discussion, because it's so politicized and so moralized all the time. The question of women's fertility and pregnancy, that there is almost no room left to talk about the issue without putting it in a political or moral context. And I think your experience is especially important because you see what happens in your practice to women or who come to you, what kind of lives they have. And of course, I'm sure there are many, many stories, many different ways and reasons that women come to the decision And what's common is that it's unwanted. The reason why it's unwanted, of course, you don't moralize about it, I'm sure. And it's her reason. It's her reasoning. And she can be trusted with that decision. And I wonder, what can you tell about that?
Well, I talk to women with unwanted pregnancies and perform abortions since 30 years. So I have been talking to a lot of women. And it is always the same. So a woman only comes for an abortion if she fulfills three criteria. She has to be intelligent. If a woman is not intelligent and thoughtful, she will never come for an abortion because she says, I'm pregnant. Well, we'll see. Somehow God will help me or whoever. So a woman only comes for an abortion if she's intelligent and she has is reflecting about her situation. A second condition is she need to be able to look into the, to foresee the future or to look into the future, to plan for the future. We cannot foresee the future, but we need to plan for the future. So if a woman is intelligent, she's reflecting about her situation and it is a difficult situation. And then she's reflecting about the future and she comes to the conclusion, maybe or probably this will not have a good end because for the life situation I'm currently in, it's not ideal to raise another child. Most women who come for an abortion already have children, so they know exactly what it is about to. And the third condition they need to fulfill is they need to be able to act. So we know that frequently we're in a situation, we think, oh yeah, well, it's not good, but still, well, I will stay on my couch and look TV or will continue looking TV or whatever. So only if a woman is able to put the conclusions she came to into an action, she will come for an abortion. So to some extent, women who come for an abortion are a very hard selection of society. Intelligent, thinking about the future and being able to act. And then my observation, which when I listen to public debate, is very interesting. It has nothing to do with reality. So the public debate is a virtual debate. It's like coming from another planet. It has really no connection to the reality of women with an unwanted pregnancy. The woman who have an unwanted pregnancy and come for an abortion, they don't participate in the public debate. They have a private problem, very intimate problem in their relationship, if the partner is there. They want to solve their private problem. Maybe similar to a man who has a problem with erection. Well, he will not participate in a podium debate about male erection problems. He wants to solve his problem. He will talk to the doctor. Hopefully, he will get a treatment, a satisfaction, and then he will be happy and continue his life. A man who has a problem with erection has no motivation to change society. He wants to solve his private problem. Same is true for women with an unwanted pregnancy. They don't want to lead a revolution. They need to solve their intimate problem. That's what they do. So they don't participate in the public debate. Unfortunately, the healthcare providers, the doctors and nurses and counselors who treat this patient in most cases also don't participate in the public debate. So that's a very sad, because I think, and I'm one of the few exceptions, because I think it is our role, not only, it's our obligation actually, not only to treat women, but to understand that women cannot participate in a public debate. So I think it is our obligation to take the message, to take the content, what the women tell us and the couples tell us, into the public debate and try to have laws changed in the sense that they serve the needs of women concerned. So, but the most healthcare professionals don't participate in the debate. So who is left to lead the debate on abortion? People who have no professional experience and in most cases, no private personal experience either. What we see is that the public debate is dominated almost 100% by people who have no professional experience and no personal experience. So what will they discuss? What will they bring to the public debate? Very easy to understand. They will bring to the public debate their own wishes and their own fear and their ideological conviction. That's all. But we should not have laws dictated by people with their fantasies. And so the reality is totally different. And A good example, one crucial example is this, I would say, stupid question, oh, why do we have women an abortion? Why do women want an abortion? Very easy. Because raising a child is a very responsible act, takes a lot of time, a lot of energy. It takes part of your life as a parent. And there is only a certain number of children everyone, each of us can raise in a responsible way, period. And unfortunately, human fertility doesn't take care of us, doesn't give a shit about what we want. Fertility rolls over us. 35 years of fertility in the life of a woman, 100 million sperms in each ejaculation of a man. Wow. So in 35 years, it's a little bit like driving cars. Like you're 18, you make a driver's license, and then you go out and say, why do we have accidents in the street?
And there you even get a training. But for this,
yeah, exactly. Exactly. Because you have a driver's license, so people are trained. You have rules and regulations how to drive. You have the police to enforce these rules and regulations. And still, there are accidents. So if you're a new driver at 18 and you go out and say, why are there accidents? Are the others all stupid or what? How can you possibly make an accident? Because everyone should know how to drive in a safe way, right? You just have to obey the rules and that's it. And the older you get, the more you realize life is different than you have imagined as a young person.
And that happens in the public sphere as well. And this happens in private.
And that is true for everything. So actually, sexuality and fertility has some parallels to driving. With one fundamental difference, that driving is a rational behavior, at least for most people. Whereas sexuality, for most people, is not a rational behavior. Most people don't want to control their sexuality in a rational way. That's the goal for most people. So that makes it very difficult to prevent unwanted pregnancies. In other words, you can use and should use prevention of unwanted pregnancies, contraception, but there will be accidents. Especially, there will be more accidents if you don't encourage people to use contraception in an effective way. Meaning, you should use a contraceptive method which doesn't need to be used during sexual activity. Like if a woman takes a pill every day, regardless whether she has sex, if a woman has a spiral, an IUD in the uterus, it is there for 5 to 8 years. She will be protected during that time, regardless whether she has sex. She will always be protected. Like the first thing we do when we go into a car is we put on the car belt. Not because we think, oh, today is dangerous or this driver is dangerous, but because we say, you never know. And the same is true with fertility and sexuality. Sexuality is not a rationally controlled behavior for most people. For some it is, for most it's not. So we need to be protected always. If we are always protected, then we reduce the occurrence of an accident significantly. So the conclusion would be an intelligent government would put out all contraceptive methods free of charge, easy to access, and would make campaigns so that everyone is protected whenever they have sex. Unfortunately, that's not the case. So what we see is the policy, the family policy of most governments is increasing the number of accidents in fertility, in contraception. In other words, the family policy of most governments is increasing the number of abortions significantly, knowingly. And then you end up with many women with an unwanted pregnancy, unnecessarily high number of women unwanted pregnancy. And then they realize, oh shit, I got pregnant. I cannot raise. There's no way I can raise another child. So this woman need to terminate. And the abortion is the solution. So that's another fundamental misunderstanding in the public debate. The public debate tries to present abortion as a problem. And that's fundamentally wrong. For the women, the abortion is the solution for the underlying problem. And the underlying problem is the unwanted pregnancy. And in the public debate, led by people who have no idea what it's about, they think, oh, the pregnancy is wonderful. not understanding that an unwanted pregnancy is terrible, and not understanding that some women have an unwanted pregnancy and they cannot continue, they cannot have another child. So in the public debate, the solution, which is the abortion, is presented as a problem which needs to be prevented. And so there's this fundamental misunderstanding, which creates a lot of suffering on the side of the women with unwanted pregnancies, totally unnecessary. And this policy does a lot of harm to the society and also to the families and the children these women, most of these women have already. So it's fundamentally a very stupid policy. And I ask myself, why do we have this stupid policy? Who had this stupid idea in the first place? Because we celebrate that women can vote for government. Of course, we should vote. But why don't we allow women to decide freely on their own body and their health and their family and sexuality? So I asked my question, where did these stupid regulations come from? And if you look back into history, it's very easy, straightforward. It were monarchies and dictatorships who introduced them. In Austria, it was Maria Theresia, Empress Maria Theresia, also for Hungary. In Germany, it was a king. It was the monarchs and dictators like Ceausescu in Romania. And of course, under Hitler, abortion was even punishable with a death sentence. And women were executed until January 1945. Women were executed for having performed an abortion. And the reason is very easy. They wanted to increase their population. And especially in war times, because then these representatives, monarchs and dictators, they sent their population into war, being killed. And they sometimes say, even worded explicitly, they say, we need to replenish our population, replace our population, which has been killed in the wartime.
And of course, only a certain type of population, because sometimes regimes will use contraception or abortion against women to decrease the number of Roma women or indigenous women or whatever.
Well, it's a race. The racism may come in. And of course, those in government, those in decisive positions never send their own children to the front, of course. But basically, it is a military concept. And what is very interesting, until these days, this military concept, and it is archaic thinking. It doesn't take 2 seconds to understand that if you make abortion illegal nowadays, even if it would work, you would have kind of soldiers only in 18 years. So, but it doesn't work. And there have been numerous experiments, so to say, social experiments, showing that it does not work. Women will not continue a pregnancy to term except if they are encouraged to. But you cannot force a woman or a couple to continue an unwanted pregnancy. It's just not possible.
And it's interesting, all of this you talk about, these are very hard facts about, you know, militarism and regimes trying to get more children to be born because of their demographic goals or whatever. We still haven't talked about the church. And of course, these moral arguments are also emphasized by religious beliefs and ideologies, which are packaging everything into some kind of ideology that will sell it to religious people, that this is the right thing to do to restrict women's opportunities and access. But at the same time, I think there is also a certain kind of romanticizing life or children or whatever. And the priority has to be put on this potential life instead of an adult woman, or not even adult woman, just a girl or a woman who gets pregnant and wants to make a decision. And I was always wondering about this. And of course, there is a "my body, my choice" slogan that feminists use to fight for abortion access. But I think there is also this notion missing from even this kind of slogan, that it's not just about my body, my choice, as in, do I want to have a children or a child, or do I want to get pregnant? But as long as something is in my body, whatever that is, whatever organ, whatever, if it's a pregnancy, I would treat it as this is part of me. This is not separate from me. This is not something that is inside me. This is me. And this, my whole body is including this pregnancy, which is not something that is just like a part of a Lego that you can put in and put back or whatever, or get out of me. And this is something that I'm really missing from this whole view of women and pregnancies, that this is really their body and their decision, in the sense of their entire body is affected, their entire life, and theirs only. And there's, and this is not some kind of little piece that you can just talk about separately without her, without considering her as kind of the boss of the whole story. And I'm sure
you're absolutely right. I mean, a pregnancy is an integral part of the body of the woman, whether you like it or not, whether whatever your belief is or not. It is a factual integral part, and it is not possible to survive outside the body of a woman. And that brings us also to another frequent misunderstanding when people claim, you cannot have abortion until delivery. That is a fundamental misunderstanding, again, from people who have no understanding what they talk about. Because an abortion is a termination of a pregnancy at an early stage of the pregnancy, as long as a potential child cannot survive outside the body of a woman. It's factually impossible to make an abortion at 30 weeks, because at 30 weeks, if a woman doesn't want the pregnancy, and that in rare cases can happen, if, for example, she has a psychiatric disease and she's harming herself and also potentially harming the fetus, you need to do a cesarean section at 30 weeks. And you need to terminate the pregnancy at 30 weeks. And in that case, you induce labor or you do a C-section, you terminate the pregnancy, you don't do an abortion, because the child can survive outside of the body. So by definition, an abortion is at an early stage where the fetus or the embryo cannot yet survive outside of the body of a woman. So evidently, everything can only be decided by the woman herself. And it is interesting to see governments trying to circumvent that and they are very creative, governments over time or in the history also, to find some excuses to patronize women and tell them, on one hand, it's inside, but actually it's just, we are responsible outside. And this is totally stupid. And there have been numerous tries, and all of them came to the conclusion, finally, it is impossible to go against the will of the pregnant women. They all had to accept that fundamental fact. So in our days, we see very few attempts to go over that. But still, there's this desire, and this so-called morality is just another excuse to make women feel bad and impose them some bad feelings, some guiltiness, when in fact women have to take the decision for a very simple reason. Once they give birth to a child, they are in charge of the child too. It's not that once you have a child that everyone comes to you and asks you, can I help you? Do you need that? Your child is sick. Oh, I take care of you for a week so that you can go working.
You're not going to be poor anymore. You're going to have a job. And
it's a very contrary. But to understand these contradictions, I think it is helpful to always be reminded, where do these laws come from? And what has been the goal and the political thought and strategy behind? And until these days, it is to increase the population. So it's monarchies, dictatorships and countries leading a war who always restrict contraception and abortion together. Because if you would be against abortion, you would say, okay, we give free contraception, so we reduce the number of abortions. But that's interestingly not the case. Yeah. It's always restricting contraception and abortion. And that is very telling, because it tells you, no, actually something else is behind. And it's very interesting also, until these days, if you look at the United States, for example, a country that is in constant war. And what do? They are obsessed with restricting abortion.
So you don't see it as a religious cause? Because I think everybody thinks about the moral and religious ideologies when the debate is going on.
No, for me, it's very clear that religion is the servant of those in power.
Okay.
And I think there's also just a few words to explain what I mean. If you are king or a dictator or whatever, now you have reached that very good position, you have a huge problem, because you have a population and you need to be sure that the population is not revolting and that they are working and that they are paying taxes to support your wealth. And that's actually, if you think about it, it's not so easy. And it can turn sour very fast. And then you have a population which is unhappy with you and they may start a revolution against you. So from the first day you are in a powerful position, your main priority, your main worry is, how do I make sure that the population I extract money from is not revolting against me? So how do you do that? You need something like a secret service. You need someone who keeps them low and working and feeling bad and feeling obliged to support you financially. So that's where religion came into place. So you had these powerful politicians and then dictators or monarchs. And then they said, well, I need someone who is doing kind of the dirty job. And then some creepy religious leaders came and said, yeah, I'm happy to do that. I'm happy to do that. I have my followers and I can extend my followers, no problem. But it will cost a little bit. So what do these religious ask for being paid with? Not only money, but they need being exempt from laws, that they are be given freedom to do whatever they want with the population, even raping children, even killing people, and being exempt from law. So in a way, the religious organization gets a parallel structure inside the state. And the king or the monarch or the dictator, he's obliged to pay that high price because he has no alternative if he wants to prevent a revolution. And very interesting historical experiment has been the communist. Because one of the first things the communists did when they came to power in the Soviet Union, they excluded the church. That was, it was a very severe strategic error. Because then suddenly they had no one to keep the masses at bay. So what did they do? They had to restart from zero, sort of, and build up a secret service, the KGB. And to some extent, the KGB did the dirty work which was used to be done by the church. Only that the KGB, of course, was by far not as professional and made a lot of strategic errors and mistakes, because the church had 10,000 years experience they could draw from. And the church understood it's not so intelligent to use brutal force. It's much more intelligent to use psychological force.
And indoctrination from childhood.
And indoctrination from childhood. And the KGB was just learning. They had a very few years they could learn from. And another very interesting thing is the head of the KGB. Who is that? He became president.
Right.
Okay. So the Pope, so to say, the Pope, if you can say so, the Pope of the KGB, he was the most powerful person. And he took over. And what is one of the first decisions he took? He scrapped the KGB because he knew from inside that the KGB was not very successful in keeping the masses at bay. And he brought in who?
The church.
The masters of keeping the masses at bay. Because he understood we need someone who knows how to do that. And they will keep the masses at bay. They will make sure the population will work, will pay taxes. And the third fundamental aspect that those in power ask from the religion, I didn't mention yet, was to procreate, to make children. Because those in power need, and in their view need, they want as many children as possible. Because if you are president or dictator or monarch of a country with a huge population, you have more power. And if you sit together with your colleagues, your peer group, like in the European Union, they sit together, the presidents, who is the boss of the presidents? At the moment, it is Germany, because they are the biggest country, not because they are the most intelligent. And who is the, has the lowest rank in this peer group? Those with the smallest country. So Ceausescu, you have to say, was right in his perception. He said, I need to increase the population because there were 17 million when he started. And he said, I need at least 25 million to be someone among my peer group and to be able to have a population that can produce an economy, that can produce something so that can I can have an impact, make an impact. So that is kind of the underlying thought. And now, if you are a politician in a decision-making position, you want to increase your population, whether you're states, Russia, Hungary, Germany, Austria, whatever. And then, you share your power with, unfortunately, you have to share the power with a religious group because you cannot do everything yourself. And finally, in the end, you will come to the conclusion that the church is just much better than any secret service you could build on a short notice. So you will be forced to share your power with the church. And you give them three tasks. No revolution, the people work quietly, and they reproduce. And so that's why the church tells the people to reproduce, but they actually just do what they have been told, what they are being paid for. And therefore, it is totally impossible also to go against the privileges of the church, because that's part of the deal they have with those in power. And whether this be your current president in Hungary, or it be the Austrian government or states, you can go to any country. This is a basic power sharing. And because reproduction is part of this basic deal in the power sharing, we as individuals, we are not part of that deal. We have nothing to do. We want our private life. We our prime concern as individual citizen is to protect our private life from this intrusion from the state.
And this connects us back to abortion care. And I'm thinking of this movement that I think is rooted in religion, the conscientious objection movement, which is basically healthcare providers in some countries being allowed to object to abortion care or contraceptive care on the basis of their moral beliefs or religious beliefs. And I find this very disturbing because of the things you are mentioning, because you said, well, healthcare providers are not taking part in the debate. But at the same time, some type of healthcare providers are taking part in the way of being tools of the ideologies and religions.
So we did a study. We did a lot of publications on this refusal to treat. It's not a conscientious objection. It has nothing to do. It's really a misuse of this term. Mm-hmm. And I feel qualified to talk about it because in Austria, we have an obligatory military service. And I refuse the military service because of conscientious objection. So I know exactly what it is. It is when you refuse to do some things, you think they are morally not okay. And you refuse that service and you accept punishment or negative consequences. But that's not what is the case. And we searched and we did also film documentaries and there are several publications. We run a website, conscientiousobjection.info. And it's very interesting, again, like in abortion, to go back to the origin, to understand what's happening. And it started in England, in the United Kingdom in 1967. That's when the first abortion law was decided in Western Europe. And again, you need to understand the whole picture to connect the dots. Where does this abortion law come from? From monarchies and dictatorships. They were in this delusion that they wanted to increase the population, not by encouraging people, helping people, but by forcing women to continue unwanted pregnancies to term. So by patronizing women, that was their archaic concept. Very stupid concept, doesn't work. I said that, but that's how it is. So it worked through the last century. And then at the end of the First World War, monarchies ended and democratic societies developed as an accident of history. So it was not planned. And so people asked for parliaments, voting rights, also women voting rights and so on. So in a there was a very strong democratic movement in Europe where the population, the citizen, asked to decide themselves on various issues. And they had been overall very successful, if you take this. Yeah. I mean, some setbacks, okay. But overall, it was very successful. And it was very threatening the old power structure, which decided and patronized, which lived on the patronizing of people, not only women, but in general. And then we came to this crucial point in 1967 in the UK, when they could not upheld again any longer this abortion law. And they were forced to legalize abortion. So this conservative religious group, they tried to find a strategy how to continue their power and continued being able to force women to continue their unwanted pregnancies, even when abortion was legalized.
Mm-hmm.
If you break it down, you can say it was this old monarchistic power structure inside the democratic society, which thought about strategies to how to continue their power structure, even in a democratic society, which is fundamentally not possible. So they tried to prevent this democratic taking power from the population. And they could not prevent the abortion law. There had been numerous attempts in the parliament in the UK to legalize abortion. They were all failed. And until 67, then there was such a strong pressure, political pressure, they couldn't prevent it anymore. So they thought, okay, what can we do? It will come. So what can we do to keep the power and to prevent abortions from happening? And that's when they came up with this, and they said, okay, if we think about if we make abortion legal, but we are able to exert so much pressure to the individual doctors that the individual doctors will refuse to do abortions, then actually this democratically decided law is useless. And we can continue kind of our power structure, archaic power structure against the population. And that's what it was. It was kind of an attempt by religiously motivated people to nullify a democratically decided law.
And as in your film that you produced that is called Abandoned, and I will put it in the description so people can watch it, there are awful examples of women being forced to carry unwanted pregnancies to term. Because even though in their countries they should be allowed to get abortions, but their healthcare providers would just lie to them and would just not tell them the truth about their conditions or their fetuses conditions or their pregnancies. And they live with the consequences and they are abandoned by the state. So it's a really incredible.
Because there's no country where abortion really is an individual decision of the women concerned. Not a single country. Every country, even countries which are considered liberal, like Sweden and France and Austria, there are limitations. Mm-hmm. And there are situations where women are patronized and told what to do. So we just have kind of the those in power, they never gave up their power voluntarily. Never, ever. They just gave up as much power as they were forced to do. And so we are not at the end. And we're still in a compromise situation. And in Austria, the compromise is a little bit more towards individual freedom. In Germany and in Hungary, it's this compromise is a little bit more in towards the state deciding for the individual. Overall, over the last 100 years, there has been a strong development towards more individual freedom and decision. It has been a little bit slow, I think personally, but it's the opposite than the states. But what I see is, and that is something that you don't really talk or see much debated, discussed in the public. What I'm a little bit worried about is the current public debate, not from the conservatives. The conservatives in Europe will have no chance to reverse. There's no risk of pushback. in Europe as opposed to the States, because for a very simple reason, in Europe, there is a vast majority of people who are convinced they want to decide for themselves. And it will be politically impossible to reverse that. What I see in Europe, what I think is really worrying, is that there is a political movement to play women against men. And you see that the feminist movement has had a crucial role in overcoming these worst restrictions on abortion. Without the feminist movement, it would not have been possible. But what is happening in the last decades is that these feminist movements is more and more acting or seeing the man as an opponent, as an enemy. And I think that is actually quite a clever strategy from those in power. Because if you're in power, what you want to do is to induce a fight among your in your population. Because if your population fights each other, then they don't fight yourself.
This is very interesting. And also what you said about you are not worried about the religious pushback gaining traction and being successful in Europe, at least because people would be adamant to stick to their liberties.
Absolutely.
But I wonder, I really am wondering how it would look like when it comes down to, for example, the Orbán regime, of course, are trying to always introduce something to patronize women with this so-called heartbeat law or whatever, or the counselings or you know, just to make it more and more difficult for women to access what they need. And I really don't see... When we had a pushback, I was there talking on stage when we had this protest just right after the bill was introduced, the heartbeat bill. And honestly, I didn't see a big wide societal uproar to say, look, this is not okay. And what I really see is, you know, people thinking about this as a women's issue, and not even a women's issue in general, but certain women's issue. You know, it's not, it's never us. It's other women who have this problem. It's not me. I'm very intelligent. I'm very conscious. I'm very educated, or I'm very good. I would never be in trouble like that. Or even if I was, you know, I have my reasons or I have my good reasons, but other women don't. And I really wonder if in Hungary or elsewhere, when it would come down to it, if, you know, right-wing governments would be more and more, patriarchic and religious. And we see this in Hungary that, women are kind of left, to themselves and not it. I don't see society really getting behind, for instance, an abortion debate and really getting there and standing up and saying, look, we are sticking to this. We don't care and we will fight you. But I might be wrong. I'm just really wondering.
We would have much more progress if we would understand where the real enemy is. And if we men and women would fight together. So if we as citizens perceive us as being united against those in power, united in the fight for our liberal individual liberty in the most intimate aspect of life, then we would progress very fast. So I have searched and documented the progress over the last 25 years. And if you look at the laws that have changed in Europe over on abortion and contraception, there have been only positive developments, only. And the only kind of slightly negative and many political initiatives to roll back have been unsuccessful. In Spain, even the justice minister had to step down because he started his political career by introducing a strict abortion law, and he failed to an extent that he had to step down. And the only small progress, the small victory, if you can say so, from the religious people and conservative people, is this example in Hungary with the so-called heartbeat. It's nothing to do with heartbeat. I can explain that a little bit later. And it is very stupid. It's not helpful. But you can also look at it as a failed attempt, because what Orbán tried beforehand was to introduce a more strict abortion law, and he failed. Even in Hungary, he failed. Mm. So the only thing he got away with, if you can say so, was this really stupid but not very effective law, mm-hmm. making it obligatory for doctors to show the pregnant women the so-called, wrongly so-called heartbeat of their
fetus. Which is not even a heartbeat, of
which
course.
Which has nothing to do with the heartbeat, which is not a noise that is coming from her uterus, which is just a noise which is artificially produced inside the ultrasound machine, because there's no blood in the fetus, not sufficient. There's no heart. It's just a precursor, just like an onion is not a flower. An egg is not a chicken, and there's no heart. And most of all, there's no noise. If you would put a microphone in the belly, there would be nothing. It's just a movement which is transformed into an acoustic noise inside the ultrasound machine. Mm. So it's fantasy. It's fictional. It's just a virtual, like the virtual debate, public debate on abortion. It's a virtual heartbeat. But it's really a very small victory compared to the huge failure Viktor Orban had in his try to introduce severe restrictions on abortions.
And what about the United States? Do you see that situation as being more severe, or you also think that is not very serious what is happening there?
You see, I think we need to see what is abortion about? It's about autonomy. To what extent does a society grant to its citizen to decide individually, to decide over their health and body and life? Okay, so in a way, it is about the democratic validity in a society. To which extent is a society really democratic in the sense that the individual has the power to decide over his life or her life? That's what the abortion debate is, just on one very crucial but a small aspect in life compared to many other aspects in your daily life. To which extent are you able to decide on your life? Are you able to travel, to marry, to whatever? We have many, many. So if you look on the European context and you compare to the context in the States, it is like two separate planets, mm-hmm. two separate galaxies. It has nothing to do, and there's very little connection. Like in Europe, we started democratization 100 years ago from a failed First World War, when the Austrian-Hungarian king at that time in 1914 was so delusional, he started the First World War not knowing what he did. He died 2 years later, and his successor had to acknowledge the failure and the end of monarchy. In some words, it was a democratic development, was an accident of history. And then suddenly people decided, well, this experience with monarchies was not so nice. Maybe we decide ourselves. And so in the subsequent decades, there was a democratic development where the population, the citizen, asked more and more freedom to decide on more and more issues. More and more populations, kind of even, if you can say so, women should be included and have some freedom, and so on and so on. To the level we are here today, and with all the problems we have in our democratic societies in Europe, I think we have to be fair to say that, at least I don't know any other society in history with higher individual freedom as we have today, and combined with a very high standard of living. Mm. So that's actually quite an impressive achievement, a revolution, really. And we are not at the end. So there are still some things to do to achieve really democratic freedom, for example, on the most intimate aspects of life. And this perception is extremely widespread in Europe. And in the States, it's totally different. In the States didn't have this monarchistic societies 100 years ago. On the very contrary, they started from a society with almost 100% individual freedom. That's what the Western society, well, they kind of, they erased the existing, pre-existing societies there and killed them and tortured them, which is a moral issue apart. But the Western, the kind of Europeanized societies, citizens there in the beginning of the United States of North America, they had much more individual freedom than anyone had at that time in Europe. And if you take the society development in the States, you could argue that people 100 years ago, citizens in the States 100 years ago, had more individual freedom than they have today. You could almost do everything you wanted. No one cared about what you did as long as you didn't kill anyone else. And that has changed. So to some extent, the society developed inverse in the States as compared to Europe. In the United States, people had less and less individual freedom over the last 100 years, where in Europe, people had more and more individual freedom. And the abortion law or the restrictions or the freedom to decide over an unwanted pregnancy is just one, has always to be seen in the context of overall individual freedom.
Mm.
So I think it is not surprising that the States, with the increasing restrictions in overall society and increasing restrictions in individual freedom overall, also limit the abortion freedom, on top of the fact that the United States are a country constantly at war.
Right.
And that comes back to this historical continuity that almost all countries at war made contraception and abortion restrictive. So when people say, oh yeah, with these restrictions from the States, we'll come to this, to Europe, I think they don't fundamentally don't understand what it's about.
Okay, right.
And it's very wrong, fundamentally, factually very wrong. And I think it is a very stupid strategy, because we have, in Europe, we have so many positive examples. Just take the example of France, when they put it into their constitution. Or just last week, Luxembourg skipped the waiting period. Did you find that in any newspaper that, oh, Luxembourg was, I think, the fifth country that skipped the waiting period after France, after many other countries, Netherlands? So as a journalist, you should write an article and say, oh, now Luxembourg is the fifth in a row of countries who skipped the waiting period. Maybe we should do that too.
Just for the listeners, the waiting period is that the laws in some countries require women to wait.
Like in Hungary, between
the consultation and the abortion.
Procedure.
Right, right.
So in Europe, we are so focused on these bad examples. Oh, yeah, in the Ooh. States, everything is so terrible. Yes, it is terrible, but I think there are 250 million people. They don't need us to tell them what to do. And if they are unable to sort it out, I don't think we will have a huge impact from Europe. But in Europe, we have a lot of things to do, which we could do if we unite together, men and women, and go to our politicians and state clearly, we voted for you to act in our interest. We pay your salary, and now you have to do what is really in our interest. And refer maybe to these many positive examples. And like you said at the beginning, in Hungary, so many people take Austria as an example for Hungary. Yeah, why not? We could make a conference and say, there are several examples in Europe, Western Europe, with good examples, good experience. Why not put that into practice in Hungary? And just to tell you, you could tell your president, if he really wants to increase the birth rate, he should not make restrictive laws, but encourage people who want children.
And it's impossible. I mean, I find it impossible that, you know, Orbán or his cabinet does not know this, because, you know, even economic professionals and analysts will say, if you provide women with opportunities, with a good economic situation, with safety, long-term safety, then they will want to have families and children. But of course, his motivations are very complex.
I think the answer is ideological blindness.
Yes.
If you believe in something, you are blind to reality. And I always wonder when people talk about virginity of Mary. And I mean, I have been working in a delivery. I never saw a virgin giving birth. At Easter, when they say, oh yeah, the death, they are raising to heaven. And I say, well, even living people can't fly. I can't imagine why should dead people be able to fly. So everyone is free and should be free to believe whatever he or she wants, of course. But then if you're in a political discourse and you want to impact society, I think we should orient ourselves on reality. And my perception is that people in government position, they frequently hold a very strong belief, maybe not religious, but whatever, some they follow some ideology, and it makes them blind to reality. And I think that is one good example. Why don't they follow the example of Sweden and France with a high birth rate? I think because they are so overtaken by this archaic fantasy. Yeah, you screw a little bit and you make life difficult for women with unwanted pregnancies, and then they will decide to have another child. Maybe you should tell Orban the example of Ceausescu, that even if you would succeed, there's a high risk that the generation you create, they will kill you, because it's not an intelligent strategy.
I hope he listens. My last question, and thank you so much for this really interesting analysis of what's behind all this and what's behind the policies of abortion access restrictions or liberties, because they often cite safety as an issue also, not just ideologies or moralistic ideas, but also they talk about safety when they talk about contraception or the emergency pill or medical abortion or surgical abortion. And I really want to get your views on this, because I think it's not emphasized enough that these procedures now are quite safe in general for women, and how we can think about them instead of, you know, always painting the awful horror stories on the wall when we think about contraception or abortion care.
First of all, we need to have more healthcare professionals with real experience participating in the public debate. And secondly, more women who are concerned, who have gone through. This is one fantasy, for example, that this is so dangerous, and this is just totally stupid and ridiculous. The opposite is true. It's carrying a pregnancy to term and delivery is one of the most dangerous parts in the life of a woman. It has become very safe, fortunately, partly because of the medicine we have, but still it is a very dangerous part of life. And an abortion, whether it is a surgical or medical abortion, is one of the safest procedures we have in medicine. And the only problem for women after an abortion is that they have a next ovulation 2 weeks later and can get pregnant immediately again, because they have a proven fertility. For some women, it's a first pregnancy. The majority has children already, but for some women, it's a first pregnancy. So the abortion is a proof that they and their partner are fertile, and they can get pregnant immediately again. For the body, an abortion is not much more than a menstrual period. And 2 weeks later, they will have the next ovulation. They can get pregnant immediately again. So they need to use effective protection. Mm. And just another myth. We have, by the way, we have created a website, abortionmyths.org.
And it's also available in Hungary, right?
We translated it also to Hungarian. Dedicated colleagues from this patent organization translated. I'm very grateful. And I hope it will serve women in Hungary. Another myth is this debate about when life starts. It's a myth because, first of all, it's ridiculously wrong, because life never ends. If you look at sperms, you put some sperms under a microscope. If that's not life, I don't know what life is. So to some extent, life never ends. It's a circle. It goes through different stages. Yes. But sperms are life, and of course, ovum is also life. And that's an interesting debate, but only for philosophers. It has no practical relevance. I mentioned that in one ejaculation, there are 100 million sperms viable, most of them viable. So nature doesn't care about life per se.
Yeah.
And they just destroy, with each ejaculation, you destroy 100 million living sperms, potentially children.
Yeah, we don't shame men for that.
And even every ovulation you have, every month you have an ovulation without a pregnancy, you don't mourn because you put an ovum to rest. No, what is important, and that is really crucially important, is who is there if a child is put to life. So these religious people or conservative people who start debates about when life starts, I would also answer them, that's a wrong question. The real question, which you these people avoid, by the way, is who takes care of a child if a child is put into life? Who is really there? And then these people will tend to say, oh, yeah, yeah, then it's the woman herself. And I say, yes, right, because they are left alone. And there's no one in our whole society who is really left alone like women with a child. No one cares. And if they are responsible and have to take care of the child, fine, but then at least they also have to be able to take the decision and put their decisions into practice. It's absolutely unacceptable that people who have nothing to do in this, who will not do anything, try to impose their will on these women. To some extent, even dictator Ceausescu was morally better with all the horrors he did and he caused, and he's responsible for all the horrors he did, but at least he built houses for children. At least he had the initiative to do something. So if someone wants to save all lives on this earth, then he should be there to provide care of these children, for these children, and not just let it go and let the women take care herself. That is totally unacceptable. And that has nothing to do with moral. It's just plain cynical behavior.
Dr. Fiala, thank you so much for the conversation.
You're welcome.